Registry Matters is an independent production. The opinions and ideas here are that of the host and do not reflect the opinions of any other organization. If you have problems with these thoughts, FYP.
Recording live from FYP Studios, East and West, transmitting across the internet. This is episode 300 of Registry Matters. Good evening, Larry. How are you, sir?
I'm doing awesome. I'm glad you were willing to have me back for this final episode of Registry Matters.
I will address that in just one moment. Chance, how are things over there on the left coast?
Very, very good. Thank you. Thanks for asking.
Fantastic. So, Larry, again, I'm taking submissions. You can email crackpot@registrymatters.co. And if you are willing to be a co-host on this show, I've reported this many times and no one chimes in, so I always have to have you back.
Well, you got a little audio clip you can play about how much longer I'm going to be here.
I might have one just like that. There.
How much longer are you planning to stay?
A long time. Get used to me.
I'm after 7-8 years, I'm still trying to get used to you.
It's been that difficult.
Every day, man. Every day I wake up and wonder, how do I do it? Well, please, if you would be so kind, make sure that you head over to your podcast app, whether that's whatever iTunes calls it these days, because everyone rebrands things. Google Podcast is shut down. Wherever you get your podcast from, if you would be so kind, and leave a review and press only 5 stars, because if you don't press 5 stars, nothing else matters. Make sure that you subscribe and like us on YouTube and everywhere else that you can find us. And then if you are feeling extra generous, please head over to patreon.com and /registrymatters. And any support, even $1 a month, would be amazing. And we would thank you and be eternally grateful. Now, with all that said, Larry, what are we doing this episode? For 300 even. I was going to do something, Larry. I don't have the bandwidth at the moment to try and plan to do anything. Like, I was thinking maybe we would broadcast live on YouTube, maybe. But I just don't have the bandwidth to do anything.
Well, I understand, because you're trying to save a failing entity.
Perhaps, yes. My job isn't very much in jeopardy. We are right on the edge of saying, sorry, don't come in tomorrow.
So tonight we have at least one listener question, maybe more at the beginning. And we have a decision from United States Court of Appeals for the Seventh Circuit, and it did not go well. And then we had another listener submission of asking about a cert petition that had gone to the U.S. Supreme Court, and that petition was denied. But we're going to go over that again. We went over it a couple, 3 months back in episode 277, and then Chance is going to do an amazing situation in California about something I'd never heard of, about making a felony a misdemeanor after the fact. I love that, so I can't wait to hear that segment. So everybody, you better stay tuned for that. What state have you heard of where you can convert a felony to a misdemeanor after you've served your sentence? Isn't that amazing?
Isn't that what people talk about? You know, how do I get my record expunged, my conviction expunged? I'm like, how would you get it expunged? It's just a true thing, but that's close.
Well, it's amazing. It's magic.
It sounds like it's totally magic. All right, well, question number one says, hello, RM panel. I have a hypothetical question for you about the registry in the U.S. and citizenship, and if I renounce it, would I still have to register? Now, here's the scenario. Let's say that I am a U.S. citizen and I'm on the PFR registry and pursued citizenship in Europe somewhere, and it was granted. I give my 21-day notice to the registry people and move overseas. I now possess a EU passport. Life is good. And let's say then after a couple years, I decide, mostly for tax reasons, that I don't want dual citizenship anymore. So I write Uncle Sam and renounce my U.S. citizenship. I quit. I gift wrap my U.S. passport and mail it back. Now, a year later, sadly, Aunt Fergie passes away. She was my favorite aunt, so I wanted to attend the funeral and visit with relatives, maybe even stay a week or two. I fly to the U.S., I'm welcomed by customs, and my EU passport gets stamped. I'm in the U.S. again, but as a foreign citizen tourist. Would I legally be required to register? Thanks for taking my question. And this is addressed as Sal.
Well, when you sent that to me, my reaction was, we had one that I thought was pretty creative, but this one tops that. We have to say now that this is better than the blizzard.
In Oklahoma, in a part of Oklahoma that never gets snow.
So, yes, this is better than that. You have to give Sal credit for coming up with something like this, but I'm going to start with citizenship. I don't know the tax ramifications. I think that if you're a U.S. citizen and you have income from the U.S., from within the U.S., you may be taxable, but I would never encourage a person under any circumstances to renounce a citizenship. And the question is, Larry, why would you say that when you've never been out of the United States? Well, I don't need to go out of the United States because, like I tell Andy, a lot of things I judge by what I see. And what I can see is millions upon millions upon millions of people on waiting lists trying to get into this country, swimming across shark-infested waters on rickety boats and dying, and before the fall of the Berlin Wall, being shot out of the skies. I mean, I see all this stuff. And something tells me that either we've done a very good job of brainwashing people around the world, or there's something unique about this country. So I would not suggest that. But if Sal is determined to not be a U.S. citizen, and if he does achieve that, as I analyze this, and Chance is going to give his opinion as well, but as I analyze this, I don't see anything that would alter his obligation to register. The registration requirements are not just applied to citizens. So him being a non-citizen of the United States would not change that. What determines if there's a registration obligation is if the person has a covered offense in the jurisdiction that they are visiting. All offenses are not uniform. So he might be in one state, he might not have an obligation to register because there is no federal registry despite everybody's wishes that there is, there isn't. So the determining factor would be if the state that he's in has an obligation for that offense to be registered. If he's here, he is clearly with an American conviction. He has received due process. And that is the primary standard for foreign convictions, is was due process afforded. Well, that standard wouldn't need to be applied. He received due process in the United States. He's got a valid conviction. If he's present in the United States, if he's in a 48-hour state, or if he's in a 14-day state, or whatever the case may be, he very well has a duty to register. I can't see anything that would alter that by him not being a U.S. citizen.
I agree.
Do you have any chance?
I agree. That's probably the proper analysis of it. I mean, you know, what are you doing by giving up your U.S., you know, your U.S. citizenship? Is you're losing something, because everything else really remains the same. When you move to a foreign jurisdiction like Europe, and let's just say you're not obligated to register there, that's fine. But when you come back in, you are. And so even if you give up your U.S. citizenship, makes no difference whatsoever what your obligations are when you come back. So really, you're giving up something for nothing. I think it's just wasteful and probably ill-advised, because that passport's gold.
Well, isn't an American passport in the top five of the terms of the number of nations that it'll get you into, in terms of how respected it is around the world? I know it's not number one anymore, but it's in the top tier of passports. I cannot ever fathom surrendering my American citizenship. Does that mean that I'm delusional and think the country is perfect? No. But I think that's the oldest functioning democracy. I think we have the potential to fix our problems. Our problems, in my view, are the people not being sufficiently informed and not voting intelligently and not holding their elected officials accountable. But our problems can be fixed. We've gone through far worse problems than we're going through right now, with civil wars, major depressions, all the things we've gone through compared to what we're going through today is really benign.
Yeah, I think a lot of people think that if you renounce your citizenship, you're no longer obligated to, you know, or to abide by any consequences that may have occurred in the United States. It's just simply not true. And you really need to analyze what you're doing and why you're doing it before you do it.
So I have been in the circle of people that are actively pursuing removing themselves from this place and going overseas somewhere you know, somewhere in the kind of the middle region on the western side of Europe. I'll leave the name out. And there's one individual that I'm thinking of that he has, however old the conviction is, but he has lifetime registry requirements and pretty frequent harassment level, you know, like supervision, even like parole level supervision harassment kind of things, even now that he's not on supervision at all, has miscellaneous restrictions that he can and can't do. And by, I don't want to say fleeing, but not in the most upfront kind of way, like leaving to have better civil liberties on the other side. Isn't that something of a legit argument?
In terms of living elsewhere, yeah. But, you know, if you have to give up your U.S., you know, your U.S. citizenship to do it, may not be the best thing to do.
I'm trying to get a ad hoc guest to come on, somebody that's thinking about doing it, but he is somewhat reluctant. So I'm trying to vamp for a moment to see if he'll come on and ask it from a first person point of view.
Oh, well, I would never, ever surrender my American citizenship. I mean, you won the ovarian lottery to be born 5% of the world's population. And do we need to fix problems? Yes, but I wouldn't do that. I wouldn't care if I were on the public registry. And it's easy to say that, not being on the public registry. So I'm talking without having that experience. But this country has so much to offer, and I would not. You're never going to hear me say, give up your U.S. citizenship.
Agreed.
I completely understand. one person who is from the western side of the country, he says, I wouldn't have a problem doing it. And I'm assuming he's saying relinquishing his citizenship. He travels fairly regularly as well. I've been overseas when I was in the military, and there was something to do with taxes that earning income in another country. How much of that would be reportable to the U.S.? Maybe from federal taxes? That you've earned income as a citizen? I don't know how that would go at all.
Well, it used to be a windfall. It used to be that, you know, it was good. Things have changed over time. And I don't really know exactly what it is today, but it's different.
What the individual that's thinking about bailing says is that anything under $107,000 and you don't pay taxes. Okay. Ah. I'll let that go. Anything else on this before we go?
No, I think I've done all I can do on it. When that question comes in, my answer is not likely to change.
You know, real quick, Larry, I sent you that text from the friend of mine that traveled overseas with his update. I would like to add that in. After we do this question, I would like to add that in.
Did you want to read that? Sure.
Yeah. And I'll find, he emailed it to me. I'll have to get to that elsewhere. All right. So then this section is in custody or not. We received a listener question about a cert petition he believed was pending before the U.S. Supreme Court. It turns out we've already talked about it back in episode 277. Can we briefly go over it again just to recap where we are?
I think so.
Very good. Well, all right. Here's what I said back in 277 after immense amount of research studying the cert petition, etc. In 2017, Clements filed a pro se, and there's your favorite word on the planet, he filed a pro se cert petition for a writ of habeas corpus in the United States District Court of the Middle District of Florida, pursuant to section 2254. The state moved to dismiss, arguing that the district court lacked jurisdiction because Clements was no longer in custody. Clements replied to the burdens of PFR registration, along with all of the other restrictions that come with being a registered PFR, and it should be sufficient to establish custody. Now, I think it's important that this person is in Florida, and Florida is, like, awful. And what did the district court decide from there, even though this person's in Florida?
They dismissed the case for lack of jurisdiction because Clements was not and is not in custody.
Then he appealed to the 11th Circuit. And how did they resolve the case?
As I stated on Registry Matters 277, the Court of Appeals decided that the proper inquiry for resolving the question presented as to whether Florida registration reporting requirements substantially limit Mr. Clement's actions or movement. The Court of Appeals concluded that they do not. It reasoned that the petitioner is not at the beck and call of state officials because his reporting requirement is periodic and predictable. Furthermore, he is not required to live at a certain community or home and does not need permission to hold a particular job or to drive a car. And lastly, he must provide in-person advance notice of trips outside the state and outside the country, the trips themselves do not require any permission from any state official. So he doesn't have to gain permission. All he has to do is report.
And in your understanding of, you know, specifically a Florida kind of place, are you aware of anybody that has been denied saying, I need to go here for yada yada reason? They say, okay, thanks for letting us know.
Well, if you're just on the registry and not having to report to a supervising, they don't have the authority to deny. You can go any damn where you want to go.
But you do have to tell them.
But you don't need permission. And that's the lack of control. Yeah.
Yep. I gotcha. But I don't remember the terminology, Larry. Please, Chance, help me out too. That there are conditions of supervision that resemble, is that a right way to phrase it? That they resemble being in custody?
Chance is gone. But yes,
you mean custodial type conditions?
Sure. I mean, some of the registry things are pretty invasive disabilities and restraints, et cetera, et cetera. So do at some point in time, in certain circumstances, don't they start to resemble having some kind of custodial control?
Yeah, somewhat sometimes. Yeah.
Anything else to add there, Larry?
No, keep going.
Okay. And so I'll reiterate the question I asked in 277, and here we can get Chance to chime in too. He does have to get permission to work at a particular place. Wouldn't you have to do that with residency restrictions like the 1,000 feet or 2,500 foot rules that exist in Florida?
No, he doesn't have to get permission to live anywhere. He can move anywhere he wants to. Now, if you make a bad choice and don't do your homework, you may find yourself in an exclusion zone. But that is not the same thing as having to get permission. It's like I tell people about international travel. You can go anywhere you want to go. They may not let you in, but nothing precludes you from going. And he can buy a house. He can rent an apartment any place he wants to in the state of Florida.
It's almost a benefit having to get permission first so that you don't end up going through the whole process of buying or renting. And then you're like, sweet. Now I'll go get the registry office to let them know I've moved here. And they go, oh, sorry, that's 999 feet away from a thing. You can't live there. And like, I've signed leases and gotten mortgages, et cetera. And now they say I can't live there. Because there's not really an easy way for us to figure out where you can and can't live.
Well, that's precisely what happened in the Martin Koff case. He had gotten permission. Yeah. He had cleared it. And then they told him he couldn't live there. Now that's what's funny.
Funny. You and your words for funny. So Clemens had filed a petition for cert, and that is, Chance, please pronounce the full word.
Certiorari?
Yeah, that one. Yeah. With the Supreme Court. He applied for cert with the Supreme Court. I can't say certiorari. And I asked you for your opinion on his strategy, and you stated at 23 minutes and 16 seconds, I can't do a Larry voice. I'm not terribly optimistic. And explain why you were not optimistic then.
Well, I was not optimistic because Clements is clearly not in custody, as the term custody is defined. We can go around this all as long as we want to, but he's not in custody.
I asked you then why you can't understand that registration with all the requirements is not the same as being on probation and parole. You can't put those two together still?
No, and I cannot, because it's not the same by any stretch of the imagination. And I'm pleased that the U.S. Supreme Court justices and their law clerks and the 11th Circuit, they're listening to this podcast because they both see it the way I see it. I see there's some similarities, but there are many differences that distinguish one from the other. A person on probation is subject to a plethora of rules, such as no recreational drugs, no alcohol use, no significant financial transactions without prior approval, restrictions on who they can associate with without prior approval, to have travel restrictions where you need a permit. Other than Alabama, I'm not aware of any state that requires a PFR to have a permit to travel when they're simply just on the registry. Registrants only registering are not subject to curfews, with a few exceptions, like maybe on the Halloween blackout periods. They're not subjected to drug testing, polygraph testing, and on and on. So you can wish it's the same, but it's not.
And Chance, do you think that this individual would have had a better shot at having any sort of traction if he had gone after the disabilities and restraints side of things, that this doesn't really resemble a civil regulatory scheme, that it resembles something more like punishment?
Yeah, well, you know, people try to do that. Unfortunately, you never hear of anybody really succeeding. Everything almost always fits in that administrative box, unfortunately.
What do you think about that question, Larry?
Well, I didn't refresh myself on everything about his case. He may have done all that, but his problem was the vehicle he was using. He was doing it in a habeas corpus. He would have needed to have filed a petition for declaratory judgment, making a direct, if he was going to make those challenges you're talking about, he would have needed to have used a vehicle that allowed him to move forward. This vehicle is restricted to people who are in custody. And they have to be either in physical custody or within the extended zone definition of custody, which doesn't include simply being on the registry. Now, we had a bunch of liberal do-gooders running the courts back in the 60s and 70s, and they expanded custody to be beyond the prison walls. But we're not likely to have any further expansion of the definition of custody as long as we have a very conservative-leaning court. They're not likely to want to improve in the opportunity to have an avalanche, not just volumes, but an avalanche of these type of cases. So he might have gained traction using the right vehicle, but the habeas petition was not the way to go.
What about the things that a person is subject to in being on supervision versus being on quote unquote only the registry?
Well, I don't know what that has to do with, I'm not following the question, because he was trying to get back into court and he chose a vehicle that was not available to him. And if he wanted to challenge the registry, he needed to use a vehicle that was open to him. Habeas corpus is not that vehicle.
Gotcha. Is there anything else here?
I could have saved them a whole bunch of money if they had just asked me, is this case going to go anywhere? And I would have said, no, you're not in custody. That's what I've said for years. You're not in custody. You're not in custody.
Even using your creative Larry brain, you could you come up with a way to argue that you're in custody?
I would have not even tried that vehicle. I would have tried a petition for declaratory judgment. You know, I would have filed a constitutional challenge. I wouldn't have done that. Now, he was hoping, because the Third Circuit decided in a case called Piasecki, they had decided that they would recognize custody as being on the registry. That's the only circuit that has recognized that. It's an outlier. And the risk for this petition was that had the Supreme Court granted it and they had decided to uphold the 11th Circuit, then the people that currently have habeas available to them in Pennsylvania and all the states that are in the Third Circuit would have had that right extinguished thanks to Mr. Clements. That's the risk of doing this kind of stuff.
Sure. Are there any states that require you to have, even when, quote unquote, just the registry, require you to have some kind of approval to travel, not just letting them know you're traveling?
Alabama requires a permit, but they can't deny you approval. You just have to get the permit and have it with you. That's the only state I'm aware of.
But then is there a state on the other side that's going to come out and ask you for your papers?
And no, this is just an Alabama thing that they can prosecute you for if you didn't do it. Hypothetically, if you were required to register in Alabama and you had an encounter in Vermont with law enforcement and they see you're registered in Alabama and they notify the registering agency in Alabama through electronic means that they encountered you in Burlington, Vermont. When you get back to Alabama the next time you're in, they're going to say, oh, well, did you get a permit when you were in Burlington, Vermont? Well, no. Then they've got a registry violation that will send you to prison, and probably in Alabama for a very long time, because they don't have the habitual exemption that we have for registration violations. Since it's a civil regulatory scheme, it can't be used as a habitual offense enhancement here. But in Alabama, it likely would be, and they could be going to prison for a very long time.
Gotcha. You have anything to add on to that, Chance?
No, just one word, and it is sad.
That it is. This isn't like in the script. I wanted to add it in real quick because I got an email from a friend of mine. All the people that want to go travel and ask about, can you go here? Can you go here? I'm going to read you a letter from my friend, and then I'm going to add in an exception, I guess you could say. So it says, hey, Andy, I wanted to update you and let you know that my wife and I left Saturday and just got back from Caraco, which is an island off the west coast of Venezuela. My wife had some points to burn from booking sandals vacations, so we tried out that resort. It was absolutely amazing, by the way, but I had zero issue getting into that country. They used to be a Dutch-owned, and I never even talked to a live person, he said. Just scanned my passport and went right through. Keep in mind, I'm a level one. This guy is from Georgia. And there's nothing on my passport to indicate that I'm on the list. I've only traveled while on probation once, and that was with the court's permission, and that was when he went on his honeymoon. That said, we flew into Miami. I naturally got pulled aside and waited for 30 minutes for them to do whatever it is that they do, and the officer, quote-unquote, asked me, who are you traveling with? I said, my wife. Does she know? He says, yes. That was it. Nothing else. Weird as hell, but I'm used to weird. So far, I've been to Jamaica 3 times, Bermuda 2x, St. Lucia, and now Caraco. The most consistent thing that's happened was that I get pulled over coming back into the country, asked a few questions, and let through for a total of 10 to 15 minutes. One time, both my wife's luggage and mine were searched, and this was the longest wait, which was sending my wife over the edge because we had a connecting flight from Miami to Atlanta. Just thought I'd share that with you, and hope you're doing really well. The one caveat is there's somebody else, and he's in chat with us tonight, and he got denied going into Jamaica. And what I want to impress with reading that and the other information is your mileage may vary. They may let you in. They may not. They're not obligated to, but that's just like this individual has had no trouble traveling all over the Caribbean, and another person has had trouble traveling in the Caribbean.
Well, I would agree with you. Your mileage is going to vary. And I would encourage you, if you want to have the right to just enter a country at will, then let's press the American government to grant that same privilege to people coming here, that they can just enter America at will. Regardless of what they've done in the past, they can enter our country and roam around at will. And when we're welcoming of other people doing that, then we have a moral high ground to stand on. But right now, we don't, because we deny a lot of people admission here. And criminality, former convictions, but convictions, all sorts of things get you denied entry into the United States. Being on a suspicious list, all sorts of international intelligence will keep you from being admitted to the United States. And amazingly, Americans don't have much of a problem with that. It's only when they're denied that they have a problem with it. So if we have a little intellectual honesty, if we want to open our borders to anybody who wants to come here, then I will hear your argument. But right now, my sympathy is not with you because we're a very unwelcoming country ourselves.
It was sort of part of the platform of the previous president that if I'm elected president, I will deny entry to all of this particular group of people. And that person was elected.
You can't say that on this podcast. We're non-political.
I didn't specify which president. I just said the former one, and I didn't specify which group he denied. Yeah, so I kept it kind of neutered. Chance, what do you think?
Well, besides, I'm looking at the question and I'm listening to it, and there's reasons why people get denied. I mean, you know, if you have a marking on your passport, if, you know, you come into the purview of IML and things like that, denial is a whole different program. I'm not sure what he was convicted of and whether or not he would be required to have a mark on his passport or anything like that. So I really can't tell from the question, but this seems to be on par with what the general experience is across the board. And so, you know, it's not discouraging. It's actually encouraging.
I can give you the teeniest little bit. So he's, like you said, he is a level one, which in Georgia is the lowest risk. His crime does not involve a minor. I don't know how much of that is information that is relevant to you.
Oh, very relevant. Okay. Because if it has something to do with the minor, then IML kicks in. If it doesn't, then it doesn't. And if IML kicks in, you know, there's notice and a mark on your passport.
He would never be subjected to having the marking on the passport. He's just always clear of that.
He is, because if it doesn't have anything to do with a minor, he's okay. Not under the purview of IML, and therefore he can pretty much roam at will.
Gotcha. And I assume that the entering country, particularly ones that are closer to the United States, are going to have at least somewhat easier access to look at our whatever database that would show you as being a felon. I assume so.
Not necessarily, but you know what they are privy to is what you have marked in your passport on the endorsement page, or what's sent to you, which generally comes ahead of time after the marshals check the manifest of the air flight you're going on. So, you know, not being purview, you know, not with the IML not applying, you're in a way better position to get to where you're trying to go and to get in. That's for sure.
I gotcha. I understand. So he is in a better position than the majority of the people in our circle here.
As long as his conviction has nothing to do with a minor, yes, that's true.
I see. I'd never really thought about it that way, I guess, because I've known he doesn't have a stamp for a while. All right. Anything else?
Well, just keep in mind that IML is not carved in stone. It could change for the better or it could change for the worse. Congress can always reauthorize, amend, or repeal. They're not going to do any repealing, but the IML as it currently is constructed doesn't mean that's the way it's always going to be. People, I get a laugh out of people when they say, well, I want to go to Vermont because the registry's not so bad. I say, well, but who's to say it won't be bad 6 weeks from now?
Yep, absolutely.
True.
All right, well then, go ahead, Chance. I'm sorry.
True.
Are you a first-time listener of Registry Matters? Well, then make us a part of your daily routine and subscribe today. Just search for Registry Matters through your favorite podcast app. Hit the subscribe button and you're off to the races. You can now enjoy hours of sarcasm and snark from Andy and Larry on a weekly basis. Oh, and there's some excellent information thrown in there too. Subscribing also encourages others of you people to get on the bandwagon and become regular Registry Matters listeners. So what are you waiting for? Subscribe to Registry Matters right now. Help us keep fighting and continue to say FYP.
Then we have a Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals decision. Let's get into this case from the Seventh Circuit. This just came out yesterday. This is why we can't ever do the podcast until Saturday, Larry, because stuff happens on Friday. Selena Montoya, Jennifer Tyree, Ronald Molina, and Zachary Blaye. I don't know how to pronounce that name. Any suggestions?
Bly.
You think that's just Bly?
I don't know, but I kind of like it like that. Yeah.
All right, fine. Then we'll just say Zachary Bly. They brought a class action lawsuit against the Illinois Department of Corrections, challenging an IDOC policy restricting contact between a parent of a PFR and her minor child while the parent is on mandatory supervised release. The plaintiffs allege that this policy violates 14th Amendment procedural and substantive due process. The district court entered judgment largely for IDOC. Is this Mark and Adele's case?
It actually is.
Oh, how about that? All right. The case went up on appeal, and so then what did the Seventh Circuit decide?
They stated, though we agree with the court that the IDOC's policy does not violate procedural due process, we hold that its ban on phone contact violates substantive due process. On this record, call monitoring is a ready alternative to the phone contact ban that accommodates the plaintiff's right to enjoy the companionship of their children at a de minimis cost to the IDOC's penological interest. We therefore affirm in part and reverse in part. That's what they said.
Okay. Can you dumb it down specifically for me? I took a test for my college stuff today and my brain is pretty much zapped. Would you please explain the difference between substantive and procedural due process?
Well, we've got a lawyer here, but I'll try. It says my thinking is substantive due process. Substantive due process goes to the very core of whether the government can regulate the conduct. And procedural due process refers to the process itself, meaning what rights do you have as the process moves along. So there's a procedural due process where you must be afforded the right to this, the right to that, timelines, calling witnesses, being apprised of the charges against you, having the right to call your own witnesses. But the substantive due process is, can they actually regulate in this arena?
Do you disagree with any of that, Chance?
No, that's actually a pretty precise definition, yes.
I could have asked ChatGPT, probably. I could have said, explain it like I'm five. And then in Illinois, a parent on mandatory supervised release who has been convicted of a PFR-type offense is subject to an IDOC policy restricting written, phone, and in-person contact with their minor child. Upon her release from prison, the person is presumptively banned from contact with their minor child. He or she may request contact, though he or she must enroll in PFR therapy if they do. How is the decision made in terms of whether contact is approved?
Oh, this is funny. It goes to the containment team to be decided.
I'm sure you didn't see it, but Chance, maybe you saw the movie Monsters, Inc., and one of the monsters comes back in with a sock on their back and like this whole team like jumps on them. Is that the containment team?
That's kind of like it. Just, you know, that's what we call procedural due process, by the way. But go ahead.
So what is the containment team?
The containment team, they use the team containment model, which I believe that the great state I live in invented that for PFR supervision. And it's something that's where you put the whole apparatus together and they work collaboratively to help the offender, which is actually helping is misleading because they help you, all right, but they help you to be put back behind bars. But the team, the containment team is comprised of the parent's parole agent, a PFR therapist, and the parole commander for the district. And it evaluates the risk he or she poses to the child. The parole agent considers the parent's compliance with mandatory supervised release conditions, including compliance with all the rules. The therapist assesses the risk of harm to the child and makes a dangerousness determination. And this assessment holds considerable weight because the therapist's expertise in evaluating the PFRs, they're supposedly the expert. Each therapist may use his or her own policies to reach a contact recommendation, including policies related to how long the parent must be enrolled in therapy before the therapist makes such a recommendation. The team must give the parent an initial decision within 21 days. If the containment team restricts or denies contact, it must provide the parent with written reasons for the decision and review the restrictions and prohibitions every 28 days. I mean, doesn't this sound like a lovely model? A therapist may deny contact on the basis of insufficient therapy to make a recommendation to allow child contact.
Like, so this is even for people that have a crime unrelated to their family member.
It wasn't clear when I was going through that decision if that's the case, but it seems to be. But I don't want to jump too far out on a limb.
Yikes. So Chance, is there an administrative appeal process with the IDOC?
Yes, according to the court, the parent may appeal the containment team's decision to IDOC's manager of sex offender services, Sarah Brown Foyles. And Brown Foyles serves as an independent appellate decision maker, if you can believe it. She does not oversee the containment team members who make the initial contact determinations and does not participate in their decision-making process. Sometimes, Foyles is not independent. Typically, when the containment team has solicited her advice about a particular contact request or when she supervises the sex offender therapist on the containment team. But In those instances, a different appellate decision maker will hear the appeal. Either IDOC's chief of programs, Alyssa Williams, or the clinical director at the Big Muddy River Correctional Center, Heather Wright.
The plaintiffs argue that the policy violates procedural due process because, number one, it fails to provide a sufficiently neutral and impartial decision maker. Two, it lacks a pre-deprivation hearing. Three, its post-deprivation process is not prompt and fair. To determine whether IDOC's policy violates procedural due process, we consider the three factors outlined in Matthews versus Eldridge. And that somebody else read what where that case law is.
424 U.S. at 319, and that was a case from 1976.
Very good. All right. And so number one, the private interest affected by the policy. Number two, the risk of erroneous deprivation of the interest and the probable value of additional and substitute procedural safeguards. And three, IDOC's interest, including the administrator or fiscal burdens of the additional safeguards. Does anybody think that those are good arguments?
Yeah, they are. I think they are.
All right. Well, how did the court weigh in on the Matthews factors, Larry?
Well, I'm going to take the first two because they're easy to read.
Good.
The first Matthews factor, the private interest affected by the policy weighs in the plaintiff's favors, what they said. Their right to enjoy companionship of their children is perhaps the oldest of the fundamental liberty interests recognized by the Supreme Court. And they gave a citation that I omitted. And the second factor, the risk of erroneous deprivation and the probable value of additional safeguards weighs in favor of the Illinois Department of Corrections. If the policy did not provide for a neutral and impartial decision maker, there would be significant risk of erroneous deprivation. Now, that's humorous because there's nothing detached and neutral about that decision maker. But go ahead.
Well, I mean, additionally, right, they said the third Matthews factor, IDOC's interest, including the administrative or fiscal burdens of the additional safeguards, may cut in plaintiff's favor. It's unclear from the record what burden IDOC would face if Prisoner Review Board, the PRB, had to solve the problem as an initial decision maker, and IDOC does not address on appeal the potential burden of this additional safeguard. Similarly, in assessing the third Matthews factor, the district court addressed the burden to the IDOC of providing an independent appellate decision maker, such as Williams or Wright, but not the burden of providing an independent decision maker in the first instance. The burden of this additional safeguard may be minimal, but regardless, the third factor does not outweigh the second, which favors IDOC not only because of the risk of the erroneous deprivation, well, the risk that the erroneous deprivation is low, but also because the probable value of the additional safeguards is negligible. IDOC's policy, therefore, provides for a sufficiently neutral and impartial decision maker and does not violate procedural due process on this basis.
And have you got a little track you can play for right here? Because that's what I think needs to be played about what I think about what they just said on that third factor.
I need a hint.
My favorite laugh track.
Oh, that one. That one?
That one.
Okay. Oh, all right.
Yeah, there's nothing impartial about this, the neutral or impartial about this process that IDOC has. That's how hilarious that is. But go ahead.
Yeah. And what will be the net result of this decision and going forward? What will the decision be from there?
Well, you can say goodbye to the phone contact or to the phone contact ban, but I think that's about as far as it goes. What do you say, Larry?
Well, I didn't see a lot of hope unless the attorneys were to come up with something amazing on a motion for rehearing and reconsideration. I think this case is largely over with. I mean, they could certainly file a cert petition, but I'm not optimistic about a cert petition. So rehearing is their only option. Otherwise, this is a very limited but good decision and within its limitations. I mean, it's a win.
Sort of. I mean, kind of, yeah. So we have had, gosh, is it Ashley from your neck of the woods there, Larry, the attorney?
Yes.
She has said in like no uncertain terms that the parent has a right to the child. Doesn't this go against what she is saying there?
It does indeed. It very much does. But you can be deprived of life, liberty, and many deprivations with due process. The Seventh Circuit seems to be saying that while you're being punished, and MSR, mandatory supervised release, is a part of your punishment, they seem to be saying that with this robust protection that they see, that deprivation can continue while you're being punished. It ends when you're no longer being punished, and possibly sooner, but they're saying that it's not, it doesn't violate the Constitution.
Interesting.
That's exactly what they're saying.
Head over to, God, I can accept the answer that if your child is the victim to whatever you've done, that would be an off limits area. But it just, like, I'm sure somebody screwed this up, and that's why they are then piling this onto everyone else. But I thought this whole process was about rehabilitation and reintegrating back into society and teaching you the ways that you've been wrong, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. This seems to push back against that and demonize you and punish you against the thing that you would cherish most, which would be your family.
Hit that button again, please.
Oh, okay. I got it.
Rehabilitation. That's long, in the past.
Yeah, don't poo-poo that too much now, because we're going to get into the California corner in a minute. We're going to really be talking about it in general.
Well, why don't you take it away with that segue?
Okay, well, here's the California corner. And you know, I mean, yeah, what you said is kind of right. I mean, you know, what's this all about? And is rehabilitation a reality? Well, no, there's no Department of Rehabilitation. But there are little tiny sparkly things. And this is a little tiny sparkly thing that I think is really good. I'm going to highlight this in the California corner. We're going to call it positioning yourself for relief in California by reducing felony convictions to misdemeanors for the purpose of lowering your tier designation. Everybody's probably fainting right now, but okay, I'll take that. Let's talk about California wobblers. In California, there are a class of crimes that may be charged as either a felony or a misdemeanor. They are called wobblers because they wobble from being misdemeanors to felonies, depending on the circumstances, of course, and whether the district attorney decides to charge you with the felony or the misdemeanor. For example, let's take Penal Code Section 311.11a. In California, that's possession of child pornography. Now, the way you determine whether or not it's a wobbler is what the punishment section says. So let's look at this. Every person who knowingly possesses or controls any matter, representation, or information, data, or image, la-da-da-da-da, is guilty of a felony and shall be punished by imprisonment in the state prison or county jail for up to 1 year. Okay, and forget the fine part of it. The most important part is imprisonment in the state prison or county jail for up to 1 year, and that's really important. The county jail part of the punishment makes the offense a misdemeanor, while the state prison time makes it a felony. Whether or not a person is convicted of this type of offense has been convicted of a straight felony or a reducible felony depends on a couple of really important factors. First of all, prison and probation. If you do your time in prison, if you did time in state prison, you're not eligible for reduction. Your felony is a straight felony and will always remain that way. If you're granted probation, if you were placed on probation and did not do any time in state prison, you are eligible for reduction even if you were given a suspended sentence. Now, a lot of people in California don't really understand this. They think that a suspended sentence means they were sentenced to prison, therefore you can't reduce their felony to a misdemeanor. Well, a new law came into effect in 2019, and it allows persons who receive a suspended sentence to apply for a reduction if they were placed on probation. Now, let's get down to where the rubber really meets the road. In California, under Penal Code Section 17B, the court has discretion to reduce a felony conviction to a misdemeanor when the felony is classified as a wobbler offense. And I get that from People versus Superior Court of Los Angeles County. The case is called Alvarez, and it's a 1997 case, which is found at 14 Cal 4th, 968, at page 974. Now, the court may reduce the offense even if the prosecution objects. And this happens all the time. Sometimes it's policy to object. Whatever it is, the court can make its own independent determination under People v. Thomas, which is a 2005 case, 35 Cal 4th, 635, found at page 640. And Estabar versus Municipal Court, it's a 1971 case, 5 Cal 3rd, 119. Now, furthermore, the court has jurisdiction to reduce an offense to a misdemeanor even after the period of probation has expired. And this probably freaks out Larry because he can't believe this, but this goes back to a 1966 case, Meyer versus Superior Court of Sacramento County. It's a 1966 case, 247 Cal App 2nd, 133 at page 140. Freaks out prosecutors, and then they check it out and they say, "You're kidding me." Yeah, it's quite correct. So what are the consequences of relief? Let's talk about the California Registry. If you're successful in getting your felony reduced to a misdemeanor, the court will send a report to the California Department of Justice to let them know that you now only have been convicted of a misdemeanor. Once that occurs, the Department of Justice will or should change the records for your case. That's another talk altogether. But this is what, you know, they're obligated to change the records. And also, this can trigger a redesignation of your tier level in some cases. And so let's take our example again. Penal Code 311-11A, possession of child pornography. It is, as a felony, a Tier 3 lifetime offense. But when you have the reduction occur and the records then are transmitted, the record is transmitted to the DOJ, they've got to redesignate it. And it goes from Tier 3 to Tier 1. So you go from life to 10 years, making relief for this conviction available. Magic. What say you, folks?
I say that is the most amazing thing I've ever heard of, and particular the Meyer case being from 1966. Your courts weren't overrun by liberals in 1966. How did they come with such a progressive decision that many decades ago?
The answer is, I don't know, but I'll tell you one thing. It's certainly very useful.
Well, that's amazing. I was, in pre-show prep, I was saying reducing a felony to a misdemeanor after the sentence has expired. The only thing I've ever heard about doing is you can do an order nunc pro tunc, and you could change it by that way. And you could explain nunc pro tunc because it drives Andy off the rails when I say that. But
just the words drives me crazy.
But you could, the way we would accomplish that here is we would do a nunc pro tunc. But other than that, there's no way to do that I'm aware of.
Well, yeah. And even then, a nunc pro tunc, I mean, it has to be based on error, some kind of error. And, this is not based on error. This is actually to reward people for doing well. And it goes really towards the concept of rehabilitation. I mean, that's the underlying reason for that, is to reward people who have, you know, made amends and have done much better, and now after the fact are being recognized for it. So that's really the rationale for Meyer.
And so when you go to your next job application, it says, have you ever been convicted of a felony? You don't have to write yes because you've been convicted of a misdemeanor now?
That's correct. It's for all purposes a misdemeanor. The answer is no.
Interesting. And how often do you have a chance to use this in practice?
I do this all the time routinely, all across the state of California.
Huh. Very cool. How can people find you, Chance?
And to take one more step, to go one more further, after I do it and it gets transmitted to the DOJ, we get a redesignation, and people come off the registry, and it's amazing.
Wow. That is pretty, pretty, pretty cool. That's pretty awesome.
Yeah, California kicks, sometimes.
Sometimes.
Yeah.
So, well, I love it. So how do people contact you to get this reduction? Because I'm sure our audience has thousands of people.
They can find me. They can find me at my office number. They can Google me, or they can call you too. You'll know where to tell them where to go.
Well, your phone number's right up there on the screen right now. So it's 949-365-5842.
Excellent. Thank you so much.
They're going to get an automated voice response, and they got to go through your secretary. Then they've got to go through another gatekeeper to get to you.
Nah. I mean, if they leave a message, I'll call them back, and within a reasonable amount of time, they'll find me.
Large law office with 10 staff attorneys.
Quadrillion. No, actually it's a boutique firm where we do, you know, we're really an operation that's handheld and very close to our clients. So it's a very cool operation.
Very good. Larry, I'll let you have one article.
Well, we can do very quickly. The Georgia sheriff asked the Court of Appeals to toss his conviction.
All right. Well, here's the title. Former Clayton County Sheriff Victor Hill argues he did not know his use of restraint chairs as punishment was criminal, and that a holdout juror was coerced during deliberations. Oh, boy. All right, then. What is this about?
Well, I don't know anything about the holdout juror, but Victor is quite an amazing character. That's a county I spent a lot of my time in my youth. And it surprises me that he can credibly make an argument that you can put someone in a chair that's called a restraint chair and not know that it's kind of uncomfortable and punitive and can be bad. Victor actually did a lot of good things for Clayton County. He actually tried to do some good as nobody's bad to the core. But I don't see how you can keep a straight face. Chance, you're a great appellate lawyer. How can you make an argument like that, that the sheriff of Clayton County didn't know that that chair was punitive?
That would be a little bit hard to do with a straight face.
So, well, either he's got a creative attorney or else he's controlling the attorney rather than the attorney controlling the client. Now, the juror, that's an important thing. If a juror was coerced, that undermines the process. So that I'm not laughing off at all, because that's a serious matter. How do you determine that? Chance, how would you determine that if a juror had been coerced other than through an exit interview? How would you deal with that?
Well, in what context? I mean, you know, if a juror complains, I mean, it's going to go straight to the court, and of course there's going to be an investigation, and everybody's going to know the facts of it, and they're going to get to ask questions and so on and so forth. I mean, seems to me that, you know, there's a built-in process for that. You know, the question is, once that's determined to be credible and true, you know, what do you do about that?
Well, you would have had a hung jury if that juror was not convinced that the evidence was sufficient and had reasonable doubt. You would have 11-1 hung jury.
That's exactly right.
The judge would tell them to continue deliberating, and then a judge eventually would ask them, in my experience, is there any hope of you reaching a verdict? Because the judge is not going to make them deliberate for weeks and weeks. So the judge would eventually say, you're split 11-1. Is there any chance that you'll reach a verdict? And if the foreperson says there's no chance, then it's a mistrial.
That's right.
Can I read a particular two or three paragraphs from here?
Sure.
All right. So later on down the article, it says U.S. Circuit Judge Robin Rosenbaum, appointed by Barack Obama, also questioned how Hill's use of the restraint chairs differed from the hitching post case. She pointed out that Hill recognized his own use of force policies and the use of restraint chairs. The policy said they should never be authorized as a form of punishment, but only in an emergency if a detainee exhibits violent or uncontrollable behavior, or to prevent self-injury, injury to others, or property damage when other control techniques are not effective. Many of the victims who were restrained testified about urinating on themselves multiple times and having scars on their wrists from being tied down. One of them was a 17-year-old who was restrained in the chair for 10 consecutive hours after he argued with his mother and trashed a house.
Wow.
Well.
Nope, not punishment at all.
No, not punishment at all, but like I say, that's not a very credible argument to me. The restraint chair, in my limited knowledge of corrections management, is exactly what the judge on the Court of Appeals said. There are times when you do have to keep a person from hurting themselves. They're under the influence of some kind of drug, and they're beating their head against the wall, or they're doing something that's going to hurt. And you have to. You have a responsibility within your custody and care to keep them from hurting themselves. So a restraint chair can be appropriately used, but it's in those rare circumstances when the person is going to hurt someone or themselves. Not because you don't like the fact that you're having to deal with this person. They've been in your jail 2 times previously, and they haven't learned their lesson. And that's the way I think Victor was having his deputies use the chair, was he was getting the message out that Clayton County is not the county to come do your mischief in. Well, sorry, Victor, that's not your job.
Well, that's a fun way to end episode 300.
Well, he was a unique and very colorful sheriff. He was the first black sheriff in Clayton County because that was a majority white county. And as the demographics changed, he got elected, and he wanted to take full command of the department, and all the command staff was mostly white because Sheriff Tuggle, who he had succeeded, didn't have a lot of minorities in the department. And he had snipers placed around the sheriff's department when he was relieving command of their jobs. His thought process was, these deputies, these commanders might go off on me because I'm taking away their command status. And you just don't treat people that way. I mean, you just don't. But it had them turn in their badges and their guns and everything under sniper protection. And then the funny thing is, they won their jobs back. They went to court, and the court said that he did not have the authority to do what he did.
Crazy, crazy, crazy. Chance, do you have anything before we head out?
No. After that crazy story, are you kidding?
Do you have any super exciting cases that you've recently worked on that you're not under a gag order about?
I've got a whole lot, and maybe we should spend one day just talking about a couple of those. It'd be fun.
I think that would be fabulous that you could bring some of those in, and we can change names to protect the guilty and the innocent.
Perfect.
Let's do it.
All right.
I thank everybody for helping us get to episode 300, because here's 300. We have 299 past episodes for you to listen to. Where are we at in years, Larry? Like 17 or 27 years of podcasting?
Well, we're well into our 7th year. I think this fall will be 7 years.
That's bonkers.
Congrats.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it. And thank you for joining the crew.
Pleasure.
And so without anything further ado, head over to registrymatters.co for show notes. And 747-227-4477 is the phone number. registrymatterscast@gmail.com. If you have really creative scenarios that you'd like to toss at Larry and Chance, you can send them there. And then head over to patreon.com/registrymatters to sign up to be a patron, gain access to the Discord server, to listen to us record live, and all that other fun stuff. And Larry, I hope you have a great night and a great weekend. Chance, the same. Even though it's 3 hours earlier, so your weekend seems longer.
Thank you. Thank you. You too.
Have a great night, guys. Talk to you soon. Bye.
Thanks.
You've been listening to FYP.